Okay, so we're talking about whether this hybridization stuff has any reality to it and what kind of experiments could we do to test it. And we're going to talk about experiments that are done with XH3, where X is boron or carbon or nitrogen, differing, of course, only in the number of electrons not involved in bonding on the atoms. And we talked last time about the fact that hybridization is related to geometry. So if we study geometry, we can study hybridization. Now, the question is how to optimize hybridization for the X atom to get the lowest possible energy. So there's going to be one X electron in each of the three bonding pairs, one coming from hydrogen. And whatever's left over is going to be in the fourth atomic orbital on whatever parts of S and P are left over after making those three bonding atomic orbitals. So, the three XH bonds, we've talked about how hybridization is related to overlap, that the best possible overlap is SP, but at normal bonding distances, but you can only make two of those. So if you have to make three, better to use SP squared. So the three XH bonds vote, and they say, let's use three SP squared hybrids, that'll maximize the overlap. But that's not the only game in town, because the atom has its own preference. It says, okay, we'll make three bonds, but be sure that you don't waste any of the S orbital. Right? Because the S orbital is lower in energy than the P orbitals. So if you have vacancy in the S orbital, that's not good from the atom's point of view. Okay, so sometimes they agree, the atom and the bonds, and sometimes they disagree. Consider having three or four or five valence electrons. So in the case of boron, if you want to maximize the S, you should put all the S where the electrons are, into those three bonding orbitals. And that would put a third into each of the bonding orbitals, use up the S orbital completely. So it would be three SP squared orbitals and leave the P orbital vacant. The high energy orbital wouldn't have any electrons. Great. If you're nitrogen, then if you want to be sure to make the best occupancy of the S orbital, you want to put the unshared pair in the S orbital. Right? Because to the extent that the bonds have S orbital in them, right, the electrons that are in the bonds spend part of their time on nitrogen and part of their time on hydrogen. But for the unshared pair, they're spending all their time on nitrogen. Right? So you get the best average occupancy of the S orbital of nitrogen if you put the unshared pair completely in the S orbital, and then use P orbitals to make the bond. Is that clear to people? That you're putting two electrons from nitrogen in the unshared pair and only one into the bonding orbitals. It's true that there's another electron coming from hydrogen that's going to be in those bonding orbitals, but it's not spending all its time in those bonding orbitals. Part of the time it's on hydrogen. Right? So you're going to get the best S orbital occupancy if you put two electrons from nitrogen in there. Now how about carbon? Now carbon is easygoing, whatever is what it says, because it's going to be making four orbitals, each of which will have one electron from carbon in it. Right? And the S, you're going to have to use the S and the three P's to make up these four orbitals. So however you slice it, you're going to use up the S, either putting it in the non-bonding or in the others. You're going to get the same nitrogen atom electron occupancy, however you do the hybridization. So carbon just doesn't care as far as the S orbital occupancy. Okay, so now let's compare these two. So the bonds want to use SP squared. The atoms sometimes want to use SP squared, but sometimes want to use P, and sometimes don't care. Okay, so they agree for boron that the hybridization should be sp squared. Gives the strongest bonds, gives the best occupancy of the s orbital. Great. So BH3 on both accounts should want to be planar with sp squared hybridization. So it should strongly prefer to be planar. Now, carbon, the bonds want to be sp squared, but the atom doesn't care. So still it'll want to be sp squared, but it won't want to do so as much as boron does, which has two reasons to be sp squared. So carbon will also prefer to be planar in our prediction, but less strongly so than boron does. Now, how about nitrogen? Here we have a contest because the bonds want to be sp squared, but the atom wants to have p orbitals for the bonding hybrids. Right? So NH3 is going to have to reach some sort of compromise between the two. If it compromises any place near 50-50, that is, if one consideration doesn't completely win out, then it's going to be pyramidal. The only case in which it would be planar is if it were sp squared hybridized. Mike?
Why do you say that boron has two reasons to want sp2?
Both the strong, you'll make the strongest bonds with sp squared, the best overlap, and also you'll bet the best occupancy of the s orbital, because if you bent boron and used some of an sp hybrid of some sort for the vacant orbital, you're wasting that s orbital. It's a place where electrons would be happy. There are no electrons there. Okay, you'd rather put as much S as possible into the ones where electrons are. Make sense? Derek?
So when we say you're occupying it with two, so there are two...
In the case of nitrogen, yeah. Right, so there are two electrons are going to be spending all their time, the unshared pair, in that orbital of nitrogen. The hybrid orbitals of nitrogen that are making the bond, right, are going to... are going to have two electrons in them too, but not all on the nitrogen, part of the time on hydrogen. So it's two completely on the nitrogen orbital versus two partly on the nitrogen orbital. So there's a factor in favor of having s orbital for the unshared pair. But that would make the weakest bonds with just p orbitals to overlap, so you're going to reach some compromise. The only one that'll be planar is sp squared. You put any s character into the unshared pair, and it'll no longer be planar. Okay, so that's what's key, the fact that you have that unshared pair on nitrogen. That's going to compete with the bonds for the s character of the nitrogen atom orbitals. So, once again, this is what we predict. That distortion from the plane, in the case of BH3, will weaken the bonds and also deprive the electrons of s character. That's bad. Going to be hard to bend it out of the plane. CH3, distortion from a plane also weakens the bonds, but it shifts s character from the bonds to a place where at least there's an electron to profit from it. Right? So it's not as bad as it is in the case of boron. In the case of NH3, distortion away from the plane will weaken the bonds, but shift S character from a single electron to a pair of electrons, which is good. So that's the most interesting case, yeah.
What do you mean by distortion from the plane?
That is, if it wants to be planar, then taking it out of the plane by making it go like this, become pyramidal, is going to weaken the bonds, but put S character where the unshared pair is. That's good. Okay, now that we have the question of whether this is true, Richard?
Why would you take it out of the plane?
Why should you take it out of the plane?
Yeah.
I mean, what's the motivation? The motivation is to put the electrons, two electrons, into where there's S orbital. The only way to have it be planar is to use all the S orbital in three sp squared hybrids, a third in each of them. Right, that's the only way to make it planar. Right, to get any s elsewhere, for example, where the unshared pair is, it's got to come out of the plane. So is this true? Well, we need to do an experiment. So we've talked about X-ray. X-ray a good experiment for doing this? Who wants to do the experiment? What do you need for X-ray? A crystal. How about NH3? it's a gas. Now you could say, okay, we'll cool it way down until it crystallizes. And in fact, there are hotshot X-ray crystallographers who try to do that kind of stuff. But it's very difficult with ammonia. Okay? How about CH3? Well, it turns out that CH3 isn't stable. Two of them get together and make ethane. Right? So forget that. You're not going to grow a crystal with CH3s. And BH3 also dimerizes. Remember, that was one of the puzzles we had before. How does it dimerize when it doesn't have the electrons to do it, apparently? But it does. So it won't do the... We can't grow crystals of BH3 either. So forget our favorite tool, right? X-rays out. What we use instead is spectroscopy. So you can have these things in the gas phase where they're monomeric and use infrared or electron spin resonance spectroscopy, and I'll talk about those experiments a little bit. So, if we had a bent or a planar XH3, it can vibrate. It can vibrate this way. Now, I bet all of you, at least all who come from a rainy climate, which I think is all, have seen a rainy and windy climate, have seen that kind of thing. Where do you see that? Where the thing turns inside out? Your umbrella in a high wind, right? So that's called, in fact, the umbrella vibration. Okay, the going in and out of the plane one way and another. And it turns out you can treat this with Erwin meets Goldilocks. You have a certain potential because all the atoms are moving in coordination to do this. Right? So it's just one dimension that you're talking about, how much it's bent out of the plane. So you can have the horizontal axis be how much it's bent, the vertical axis be the energy. You can define a potential energy for that. And then the question is what you do with the mass, and that turns out to be a little tricky. You have to use what's called a reduced mass, but you do it to take into account how much each of the atoms is moving, the atoms of different weight, H and the X atom. So you can do it with Erwin meets Goldilocks. Now, here we're going to show the results here. Now, so here's BH3 on the left, it flat in the middle and then distorted one way, distorted the other, and CH3. We're going to compare the two of them. Now, it turns out that BH3 vibrates at, what is that, million, billion, 34 trillion 218, 210 billion times a second. Yeah.
How do you define a vibration?
Going through a complete cycle.
Okay.
Start flat, go out this way, go back the other way, and come back to flat again. A complete cycle. Okay, that many vibrations a second. And it's easier to talk about terahertz. It's 34.2 terahertz. And CH3 vibrates not quite as fast. It vibrates 18.7 terahertz, about half as fast. Okay, why? Because you have stiffer springs in the case of BH3 than you do in the case of CH3. Right? Now, here's the vibration we're talking about. B goes one way, H's go the other, right, to maintain where the center of mass is. And that interacts with the electric vector of light that's going back and forth, because as you distort it, you get plus going one way, minus, minus, plus, plus, minus, minus, plus. That's like an antenna, right? It generates light. Or it can absorb light if you put light through it at the right frequency. But by measuring the frequency of light that either is given off or is absorbed, you can measure how fast the thing vibrates, because you know the relationship between the wavelength of light. On the left, there are a lot of waves in a centimeter. On the right, there are only about half as many waves in a centimeter. The wave is longer. So you can, using the speed of light and the conversion to energy, you can calculate how far apart two energy states are, vibrational energy states, of this molecules, how far apart they must be in order to interact with light to go from one state to the other. Is that clear enough? Yeah, Aviva?
What's making them vibrate?
In Erwin meets Goldilocks, it can't just sit there at the bottom. It has to vibrate, right? It has to move. There's what's called zero point energy. Even if you're at zero Kelvin, the lowest possible temperature, still it's vibrating, right? And it vibrates at a certain rate. And if light matches that rate, if the electric vector of light bouncing back and forth is at the same rate, then it can exchange energy. This is time-dependent quantum mechanics. It can exchange energy with the molecule, and the molecule vibrates not faster, same rate of vibration, but further. Okay, it's like somebody on a swing. They have a natural rate at which they go back and forth like a pendulum. But if you put energy in, they go further. The same thing happens here. Light can go in, but the light has to match the frequency. Okay, and if you measure then the frequency of the light, you know how fast the thing's vibrating, and you know what the energy difference is between this lowest energy and the next one. That's the frequency of, that's the energy of light, of the quantum of light that gets absorbed. Sharif?
Why does it have to be the same frequency?
Because it's like if you push somebody on a swing. Have you ever watched little kids push someone on a swing? First time they go, they'll go bum, 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 and the person will just sit there. What they have to learn is that you have to push at the same frequency that they naturally swing. Then you can do it. And the same thing is true of light trying to push these things. It has to push at the right time. Otherwise, it'll be pushing when the thing's coming this way. Bonk. Right? Derek?
So the electric field of the photon has to be in phase with the electric field of the
right.
electron clouds.
Right, or at least at a given phase relationship, the same way as pushing someone on a swing. So the one on the left vibrates faster, takes shorter wavelength light, takes light whose quantum is worth 3.26 kilocalories per mole, whereas CH3 takes light that's only 1.73 kilocalories per mole. You just put these things in a cell, or generate them somehow in a cell, pass light through, see what infrared light gets absorbed, and that tells you how fast it's vibrating, and how far apart the energy levels are. Yeah.
Why do you say that BH3 is stiffer than CH3?
Stiffer? I'll show you. Okay, so all we know now is these energy differences. Okay? But what we can do is guess a Hooke's law potential and see if it gives that energy difference. And if it doesn't, change the potential until it gives that energy difference. And then we know what the potential... There's the Erwin meets Goldilocks solution that gives an energy difference of 1,141 wave numbers, or 3.26 kilocalories per mole, right? So then we know that's the potential. We get the potential from the energy difference, assuming it's like a spring. Now, in truth, it would be more like a Morse potential or something. I don't know exactly what it is for that, right? But down near the bottom, it looks pretty much like a parabola. So we can guess that it looks pretty much like Hooke's law. So we know what the potential energy looks like. How much energy it costs to deform it out of plane a certain amount. Henry?
Are we defining deformation as deformed from planar to planar?
Yeah, and you'll see something about that shortly. But this one fits the energy. All we measure is that energy difference by IR. Right? And then we generate this potential and see how much energy it costs to bend by a certain amount.
So is it in fact switching instantaneously from planar to pyramidal, or like
it's going back and forth, it's vibrating like an umbrella.
But can't there not be any energy levels between the red and the blue energy levels because the sine function doesn't exist there?
No, those are the only states you can have, right? The lowest energy state and the next one.
But if you're vibrating in between the two states, don't you go through intermediate states?
The trouble you're having is because to visualize it as actually vibrating, you have to use time-dependent quantum mechanics to see it actually vibrating. And I'll tell you how you do that quickly, but we're not going to spend any time on it. If you take the sum of the blue and the red curves, what do you get? You get something that's on the left. If you subtract the blue from the red, you get something on the right. So the vibrating thing is actually a mixture of the two. And the rate at which it vibrates is their energy difference. But don't worry about that. Okay? But since you wanted to know, I told you. Okay, so you can't pretend I'm not telling you. Okay, now in the case of carbon, that energy difference is much less. And so we use a wider parabola to get that energy difference. But what you can see is that on the left, there's a stiff spring. It takes a lot of energy to deform it. On the right, it's only half as strong, the spring. So which one is easier to deform? CH3, and that's what we said. Right? We said that CH3 should be easier to deform than BH3. Now it gets much more interesting with NH3. Because in NH3, you don't see one frequency. You see two frequencies of light get absorbed, but they're very near one another, 968 and 932, which means that our energy scheme has to look like this. When we're in the lowest energy state, we can either go to one that's at 932 or one that's 968, wave numbers above. Right? So there must be two levels that are very close to one another in energy. Did you ever see before a case where you have a ground state, but then the excited state, you have two of them that are very close together in energy? Did you ever see such a thing? Double minimum does that, right? So this is not a Hooke's law pattern. What this is a double minimum. I'll let that sink in for a second. You recognize this? Familiar? Right? That's what will give that kind of pattern, a double minimum. So, in modeling it, you can figure out how high this barrier is. It's 3 kilocalories per mole of energy to go from being bent one way through planar, which is a maximum, to being bent the other way. So this clearly shows that NH3 in its lowest energy is bent, and there's a barrier to going back and forth between the umbrella and the inverted umbrella. In fact, that tunnel splitting, as we've called it before, is 37 wave numbers. Now notice that one of those has two nodes and the other has three nodes of those two curves. So there must, down at the bottom, be something that has one node and something that has no nodes. Right? So in fact, that lower level is also split. But the overlap of those is so small that you don't see any splitting, right? It turns out to be only one wave number difference between the one with no nodes and the one with one node. But that splitting, now this is for the ground state, right? The lowest energy state, and there's another state just one wave number above, and there's a little bit of tunneling splitting between those two. And you can use that, which turns out to be 2 small calories per mole, to figure out how fast it bounces back and forth. We talked about this before in tunneling. So, in fact, you can use ammonia, the rate at which it vibrates back and forth, this frequency of light, you can use that as a clock. And that was used as a clock in the 1950s, as a very, very high precision clock, how fast ammonia tunnels back and forth between its two minimum energy pyramidal forms. Yeah.
How are they able to observe the time dependence of ammonia's vibration? I mean,
through the light. Through the light matching the going back and forth.
So they saw what was the difference, how long between certain wavelengths of light there could
be. Yeah. To talk about this in a really sophisticated way takes a little more than I'm talking to you now. But generally, that's it. It's what frequency of light interacts with it. Now, electron spin resonance spectrum measures how much S orbital character there is in that singly occupied orbital of methyl, CH3. Now, most electrons come in pairs. The electron has a spin, which makes it magnetic. But in a pair, you have two with opposite spins, and they exactly cancel one another. You don't see anything. But CH3 has an odd electron in that fourth orbital. Right, and that one you can measure the magnetism of, interact that with the magnetic vector of light. Remember, light has both electric and magnetic vibrations in opposite directions. Right, so now use magnetism to interact with the magnet. Right, so you can measure something about that odd electron. And one thing you can measure about it is that you see absorption by this magnet as it goes from being oriented one way in the field favorably to oriented unfavorably. You can see that. But